There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You are listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. Our show is all about President Trump's legal issues. They're complicated. They bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and whether the president can be sued or forced to testify while in office. It was clear we needed to devote some time each week to answering some of the biggest legal questions. So I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Last week, Ken and I went to the USC Gould School of Law to record an episode of this podcast. Here's a portion of that conversation where we talked about the First Amendment and President Trump's effects on it. Our special guest for that conversation was Susan Seeger. Susan teaches First Amendment and media law at Gould, and she directs the Press Freedom and Transparency Clinical Practice at UC Irvine. Here's my conversation with Ken and Susan. We started off by talking about all the president's lawsuits. Welcome, Susan. Thank you for being with us. So one of the key things you do is litigation around issues like libel and slander, right?
Correct.
And so the president has gotten himself involved in a fair amount of libel and slander litigation, not just in the last couple of years, as we've been following on the show, but he actually has a track record of several decades of such litigation. And you've written about that in the past. My understanding is it is not a very good track record for him.
It's a terrible track record, but it's sort of effective. And so I wrote an article about this in 2016 when he was running, and I found that he filed, actually I found another lawsuit, so 8 different libel lawsuits or speech-related lawsuits, and he never won any of them in open court. He either withdrew them or settled them. And he's a king of frivolous lawsuits. I called him a libel bully, but also a libel loser. But I wrote the article for the American Bar Association, and they were so scared he was going to sue them that they wanted me to change the article. They didn't want me to call him a loser, a bully, a guy who had red hair, who had no sense of humor. They wanted me to censor a whole lot of stuff. And I didn't do it, and it became a joke on The Daily Show how cowardly the ABA was.
Well, that's remarkable because those are all opinions. And this is something we talk about a lot in the show. Like
Or facts.
Well, wait.
My hair is orange. That ain't red.
But so, I mean, one of the key things that the president doesn't seem to get about defamation law is that you cannot sue people for opinions, even if they are really odious opinions or dumb opinions or opinions you strongly disagree with, that you will not be no one has defamed you by saying that you're stupid or that your hair is ugly or anything of that nature.
Right. No, he doesn't. Oh, I said he doesn't have a sense of humor. I mean, that's part of the problem is he doesn't have a sense of humor.
But so I thought there was a telling quote in your article, and there was one instance where he sued a journalist named Tim O'Brien. Tim actually used to be my editor back in the day at Bloomberg. And Tim wrote a book about 20 years ago at this point that said, among other things, that Donald Trump was at the time not a billionaire. And the president took grave exception to this and said, I am a billionaire, and that's damaging to my reputation, my business, if people will think that I'm not a billionaire. And so he sued him for several billion dollars. So I guess if he had won, then he would have been a billionaire. And ultimately, Tim O'Brien won that lawsuit, but it was after a long time. And Donald Trump had a quote afterwards saying, well, I lost, but at least I made his life miserable for a few years. And that was really what I was trying to do, more or less. And so I guess that seems like the system not working right? Like the system is not supposed to be designed so that you can have a meritless lawsuit and still achieve your objective of making your opponent unhappy by suing them anyway.
Right. I think that's a big problem. And O'Brien won, but it cost, as he pointed out, and I think his lawyer contacted me afterwards and said it wasn't as that much money, but that, his lawyer or his publisher had to pay a lot of money in legal fees. So, some states have tried to enact laws called slap laws, which allow you to file a very quick motion to dismiss a lawsuit that is frivolous and that can be gotten rid of quickly. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, though, because it has a sting to it. In America, when we sue each other and you lose, you walk away and you don't owe anything. You know, like, oh, well, I lost. But under this slap law, if Donald Trump sued me for defamation, I could file this very quick motion to dismiss called a slap motion. And if I could win, then he'd have to pay me back for my attorney's fees, which is kind of a disincentive to frivolous libel lawsuits. It has to be about a matter of public concern. but I'm pretty sure he filed, when Stormy Daniels sued him, he filed a slap motion against Stormy Daniels, and that's why she owes him a whole lot of money. So Trump used this very law that's supposed to stop people like him from filing frivolous libel lawsuits, and he got the better of it.
But I would note, and Ken, if you can go into this, Trump was in the right there. Like, her lawsuit against him was frivolous. It was a strategic lawsuit against public participation, and so didn't he deserve to win?
Oh, I don't know.
It was over a tweet. The tweet was clearly hyperbole, rhetoric. It was not a provable statement of fact. I think it was Michael Avenatti filed it, so no surprise. It was a bad lawsuit. It was very strategically bad. It was likely to lead to a $300,000 attorney fee award. So yeah.
Well, that's an excessive amount of money for that motion.
It wasn't quite 300,000. I don't know. I can look.
It was a lot.
It was a lot.
It was six figures.
What was the tweet again that she sued over?
So he retweeted someone else. So Stormy Daniels had claimed that she had been threatened in a parking lot in Las Vegas over her lawsuit trying to get out of this non-disclosure agreement for the hush money that she was paid not to talk about her affair with him, with the president of the United States of America, all of this being, you know, what passes for normal now. And Trump retweeted someone else saying this sketch she had a police artist do of this person threatening her looked very much like her ex. And
the president, it was a quote tweet, so he's retweeting someone else, and the president called it a total con job.
Right.
See, I disagree with you about whether that's a clear-cut opinion, because first of all, unlike when you're a reporter and you have opinions about stuff, he knows whether he hired someone else or not. I mean, he knows what the truth is, and he's calling her a liar, basically. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of hyperbolic. You can call people liars and not be sued for it. But, I mean, in this case, it's very facty. I mean, so I think it's a toss-up whether it's not like where I would just say, oh, my God, Trump gets five Pinocchios a day or something like that, which is hyperbolic, and maybe it's true, but it's... But I just feel like that one was borderline.
Well, before the Ninth Circuit, which doesn't even like anti-slap laws being applied in federal court, so we'll see how that goes. I thought that one of the most telling parts of your article and what you talk about is how it's the process is the punishment, not the ultimate verdict, not the ultimate result. And it's not just the really ruinous amount of attorney's fees. Most Americans simply cannot afford even the amount of fees it would take for you to hire someone to do a good anti-slap motion. You're talking about tens of thousands of dollars. Most people don't just have that lying around. But it's also the process is just terrible. People don't understand how brutal it is to be sued, how nerve-wracking, how destructive of your peace of mind, your relationship with your family and your friends, your ability to do your job, all of these things. I've never had a client who enjoyed it who wasn't a sociopath.
It actually was very nearly $300,000. It was $293,000, my producer, Sarah Fay, tells me. I want to ask about the terribleness of that process, which is to say, you know, different states, and even though, to your point, it is even still expensive to file an anti-slap motion, the purpose of these laws is to protect people from these frivolous lawsuits, to get them to allow them a way out of them that is less complex and less expensive than it would normally be to defend a defamation suit. Are there states that have especially good approaches here? I mean, because libel is a state law, the president likes to talk about we need to open up the libel laws, but as the president, he has no direct control over these laws. Are there states that have particularly good frameworks that both, you know, allow people to get relief when they truly are defamed, but also protect people from frivolous litigation?
I think there are about 28 or so states that have this slap law. California is one. Virginia doesn't, which is where Devin Nunes filed his libel lawsuits, several of them. But there are about 28 states, mainly on the coasts. But Florida has one. More and more states are adopting these. But we really need a federal law.
There are definitely better ones and worse ones. So the good ones, like California's and Texas anti-slap, apply to a much broader range of speech. The bad ones are very narrow and only apply if someone sues you, for instance, for making a statement to the legislature, something very narrow like that, because the original concept of anti-SLAPP laws was when developers were suing protesters for protesting property developments in their neighborhoods. And so it was a fairly narrow range of speech. It was, you know, protesting the city council and things like that. California, Texas, places like that, anything that's speech on an issue of public interest in a public forum is probably going to be able to trigger the anti-SLAPP statute.
And so, Susan, you mentioned Devin Nunes, the congressman, the Republican ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, who's been suing a number of people who he says have defamed him. And these, again, are very often statements of opinion, or in one case, a tendentious but accurate newspaper article about a winery in which he was a minority investor, where there was some misconduct on a yacht that the winery owned that was not very proximate to Nunes personally. I understand why he was irritated about the newspaper article. It still wasn't defamatory. He's been really trying hard not to file these lawsuits in California. He sued in Virginia. He has sued in Iowa. He's been trying to sue in states that do not have these anti-SLAPP protections. And so I guess you mentioned a federal law. So the idea you wouldn't federalize the entirety of defamation law? You would have the federal government impose a remedy framework on various state defamation laws? Or how would that work?
It'd be in federal court. So because a lot of people file in federal courts, and a lot of federal courts say that it doesn't apply in federal court because there's either state laws. So it would be federal legislation that if someone sued you and it got bounced to federal court, it was filed in federal court, then you would have this mechanism. It's just a fancy kind of speeded up motion to dismiss with sort of very quick evidence. The other side just has to quickly put in evidence. If they can have evidence to show, you know, that you lied or something, then they can defeat the SLAPP motion. But it's just a procedure. But that has the sting of the attorney's fees if the frivolous libel lawsuit is successfully dismissed.
So there have been different levels of aggressiveness of the proposed federal statutes. Some just apply if you're already in federal court, and maybe even apply to federal claims, which normally anti-SLAPP statutes don't. And so if someone sues you in federal court under state defamation law, you'll be able to raise this federal statute. There are much more aggressive ones that are more controversial that would allow you to remove defamation cases from state court up to federal court. Those are a much tougher sell because that federalizes, like you say, state defamation law, and it severely clogs the federal courts, which are already very overburdened.
Is there a good reason for these to be state law claims? Because the thing that keeps coming up over and over is that it's not clear where the alleged defamation occurred. That you have, you know, a commentator who's in one place talks about someone in a second state regarding conduct that occurred in a third state, and they use a web service that has offices in a wide variety of places, and so it gives you a lot of options about where you might file the lawsuit, and then it gives courts these very complicated questions about where the appropriate venue is. So I mean, is it in the internet age, is it viable to have defamation be considered a purely state offense when it's often unclear what state alleged defamation occurred in?
Well, I mean, we handle those venue issues all the time. So this is just the application of old rules to new technology. Mm-hmm. And the emerging rule seems to be that a place is an appropriate venue if you can show some intent to aim the effects of the statement to that venue. So, you know, if I badmouth you and make sure it's published in New York and I'm making comments aimed at your New York employers hoping they'll react, then under this theory, it would be okay to sue me in New York. But if I'm just making some general statement, you can't just sue me wherever you happen to be at the time and choose that. But it is still in flux in different courts across the country.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with libel being a state-by-state law, and I think there's been a lot of movement and success in getting these passed state-by-state. It's more when people go to federal court where there's an issue. Like in the Ninth Circuit, it's still the Ninth Circuit, Judge Kaczynski's complaint notwithstanding. You know, here in the West Coast, you can still use the SLAPP motion in federal court.
Since we've been talking about defamation on the internet, why don't we talk a little bit more about Twitter and some other things we've learned about First Amendment rights in Twitter, which is that some people sued the president, and we got this court ruling that you have a First Amendment right to not be blocked by the president on Twitter. Was that a good ruling?
I think so. I mean, at first, when I first heard about the lawsuit, I thought it was really stupid. But then the more I researched it and thought about it and looked into it, I think it makes a lot of sense, because what the argument is not that all of Twitter is governed by the First Amendment. It's very narrow. It's when you're a government official and you open up your social media account to the public, and this this goes for Facebook as well, and some local city council people have had this happen. When you open up your social media account to the public and you allow them and you debate and you discuss, you know, government issues, then it's just like if the city council was having a meeting here, you know, you can't just sort of tell people to shut up based on their content, on their viewpoints. When you criticize the president, you can't block them. So it's, you know, it's this called, the court called it this interactive space.
I'm with Susan. I thought it was dumb at first, and I did not take it seriously at all. But having read now, particularly the Second Circuit opinion, I think it's well put together. And the analogy that I like the most is if your town hires a private space, a hall, to hold a town meeting, they can't then tell the owner of the place to keep certain people out because they don't like their politics. So even though it remains a private space, and tomorrow when they're having a different event, that private space can kick people out, you, the government, can't, as long as you're there.
So to be clear about what space we're talking about here, because, you know, being blocked by the president on Twitter doesn't prevent you from reading his tweets. You can go into incognito mode and read his tweets. It doesn't prevent you from saying things about him on Twitter. What it prevents is you replying to his tweets in such a way that your tweet has a chance of showing up under his tweet when other people look at his tweet as a response to his tweet. And so the idea is that is the public forum. The like essentially the comments under the president's tweet. And I guess my question is, you know, if the White House puts out a press release about a policy initiative the president has, and they include some quotes from citizens about how this is a good policy initiative, they don't have any obligation to include the quotes from citizens who don't like the policy initiative or from any citizens. They are allowed to pick and choose, and that is government speech. They're deciding, you know, these are the quotes we want to feature. We're doing that. Can't it be government speech for the president to block people from his Twitter account, basically deciding, I don't like this person, I don't want this person showing up as a featured comment underneath my own comments here, and I control this as a forum for government speech?
I think when he opened it up to the public, when he allows people, just like the way Twitter and Facebook are created, where you allow people to kind of comment, then it's not the same as your press release. So you've created a little public square.
I don't think it's a terrible argument, but I tend to agree that I think that it the way the court has said it is he can still mute them. He's not obligated to listen to them or pay attention to them. But when he creates the space in which people can interact in the wake of his tweets, he can't kick people out of that virtual space. That's the theory.
What about some things that the president has done in real physical space with regard to media organizations? I mean, when he has threatened in a couple of cases actually taken away press credentials for the White House press room from outlets to punish them for various things. There's been some litigation over that, and I guess that we haven't really reached the question of whether that violates the First Amendment. The cases have been considered on other grounds first.
Right. I mean, a couple of reporters lost their press credentials and they hired lawyers and sued based on due process claims that there was no fairness to it, there was no predictability, there was no way to appeal. And so it was just a straight up due process, sort of fair, unfair procedure argument. And the courts agreed that the president can't just arbitrarily kick people off without a process. That once you open up this, you know, he doesn't have to have people in the White House, but once he opens up the White House to reporters, he has to have a fair, kind of predictable procedure.
Right. I think that probably the result would be that he can't kick people out purely for viewpoint. But where the line is on that and whether he can say, well, actually, this person is disruptive or rude or whatever, the line on that is not 100% clear. So in the Twitter case, the administration conceded, I'm not sure why, but I guess it's part of having a series of lawyers that included Michael Cohen and Rudy Giuliani. They conceded that it was purely because of the viewpoint of these people that they were blocked, which is not, again. So it would be a harder case, I think, if this person was swearing at him or being rude or abusive. Then all of a sudden you have a different question presented. What do you need? I mean, it's not, you're not putting them in jail. What do you need just to block them? So I think that will continue to develop as the technology develops and as we get harder cases.
Where is this going to leave us when Donald Trump is no longer the president? Because, I mean, you know, is there an important First Amendment legacy that will come out of what we have, you know, these experiences we've had over the last few years? Is there something bigger than we learned about, you know, whether public officials can block people on Twitter or not? As we've seen this high-profile behavior, all these lawsuits filed, what are the lessons that this leaves with us for the years going forward?
Well, We've seen development in one area, and that is the classic analysis of whether something is a provable statement of fact and therefore potentially defamatory, or whether it's a statement of opinion, rhetoric, hyperbole, etc. So we've seen the president in a series of cases where women have accused him of various forms of abuse and he's denied it. They have filed defamation suits, and depending on the nature of what he said, there's been an analysis of whether or not that was a provable statement of fact. So in the case of Sherry Jacobus, who was a Republican political operative who he basically accused of coming and begging for a job, and you know, he rejected her like a dog, he probably said, because that's what he always says. And there the court said, it's on Twitter, it's Donald Trump, everyone understands it's just bloviating, it's not a statement of fact. But then you have Summer Zervos, who accused him of sexual assault. He denied it in ways that the court eventually said, no, this was a provable statement of fact. He's actually calling her a liar, making specific denials of specific things. So we're increasingly coming to grips with how we apply this distinction between fact and opinion technology. And that's been going on for a while. There are lots of cases saying that stuff on the internet is more likely to be understood as opinion than fact, because even judges get the point that we're all hot-headed idiots online. But it's being even more sharpened during the Trump administration.
So I think what I see is two things. One is I feel that there's long-lasting damage to, and a lot of it is Fox News too, but there's long-lasting damage to what people, that people just don't believe the media at all across the board, or that they sort of equate MSNBC and Fox as the same bookends, which they're not. And I just worry about people just sort of tuning out the media completely after this, even if after Trump is gone. And I think that's quite dangerous. And the other thing is, I feel like his legacy may continue on, that especially Republicans, but people who are disgruntled, like Devin Nunes, are going to do all these frivolous libel lawsuits because they get a lot of publicity. And even if they're eventually thrown out, they feel vindicated. And I think that's a dangerous legacy that Trump has may have.
And I think it's just not just Devin Nunes, too. We're seeing an increasing array of particularly a lot of alt-right figures filing frivolous defamation lawsuits, you know, racists suing people for calling them racist, suing civil rights and interest organizations for calling them a hate group, that type of thing.
Let's take some questions. But before we take some questions from the live audience here, I actually have one question that was emailed in that I think this is a good opportunity for us to deal with. This question came from a young listener, perhaps a future Gold student in about 8 years. And she is responding to a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago about a column that Professor Stephen Calabresi from Northwestern wrote for the Daily Caller, saying the House of Representatives was violating President Trump's Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial with the way that it has handled the impeachment process. Did anyone here read about this article? Only a couple of you. It was very stupid, and this was remarkable. I mean, it's stupid for a number of reasons. You know, the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply to impeachment because it's not actually a judicial proceeding, and this isn't a trial, and so they can't be violating the president's right to a speedy trial. He doesn't have a right to confront witnesses at this stage, because it's an impeachment, but also wouldn't in any case in a court proceeding. It's remarkable because Stephen Calabresi is a tenured, very prominent law professor at Northwestern who founded the Federalist Society. And so here's the question. The question comes from Claire Newman. She says, I'm a 14-year-old who enjoys your podcast. In your last episode, you talked about this column, and you mentioned that he is a respected lawyer. I'm wondering whether you think there's any sort of red line beyond which someone can no longer be considered respected, or whether legal scholars can pick and choose in the Trump era when to actually be intellectually honest. Can someone follow Michael Avenatti's example and be a good lawyer only sometimes? Or will their careers end badly like his has? And how far does previous credibility go in the legal world? And so I think broadly, I mean, we see this not just with lawyers, but we see some people, you know, trying to defend the indefensible and making some extremely dumb arguments in the process. Can you then go back and look at other things they said that, you know, that seemed smart, and still find them to be smart?
I think we're going to have to wait to see how that plays out. Is this going to be a situation where people say, okay, yes, well, I said that then, but you have to understand that was the Trump era. The way people now say, you know, it was the 70s, you had to be there to understand. And I think there may be some of that. I think there's just this general sense that people are kind of crazy, that the media environment encourages extreme craziness and performance, and that maybe a little slack will be cut whenever all this is over, assuming it's over in a non-apocalyptic way. but I certainly feel there are some people who have crossed a red line, left and right, and that, you know, I would certainly take anything they ever wrote about the law ever again very skeptically.
I agree. I think that that's just seems so elemental that the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply to impeachment hearings. I don't know how you recover from that.
Oh, by the way, since the question mentioned Michael Avenatti, Ken, was Michael Avenatti ever a good lawyer?
I'm going to hear this forever. Yes, to the extent that he was a capable trial lawyer, capable motion lawyer, he was at times operating as a good lawyer. But when he started cheating clients, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, stealing from trust accounts, abusing clients' trust, all of that, he definitionally became a bad lawyer.
Stealing Stormy Daniels' book advance, allegedly?
Yes, stealing from the paraplegic man, the settlement from his abuse case, and so forth.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Ken White and with Susan Seeger of USC, and some Q&A from the audience. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. Welcome back to All the President's Lawyers. You're listening to a special live episode of All the President's Lawyers recorded at USC with Ken White and Susan Seeger. Let's take some questions from the floor. We're happy to take questions on essentially any subject within reason.
I'm Jen Lasher. I'm an attorney. And my question is, who do you think is the best lawyer of everyone associated with all of Trump's legal disasters? Who do you think has really done the best job? And who do you think of all the bad lawyers is like really rock bottom?
Well, one of the complications in answering that question is that so many of Trump's lawyers have not only been acting as lawyers, but as clients, as defendants and or targets of federal criminal investigations. And it's a little hard in my mind to tease apart what capacity they're acting in any given time. So I would have to say that Rudy Giuliani probably stands out the most as the worst lawyer, in part because he's still sticking on, talking as Trump's lawyer, even though it's completely clear that he has a, you know, law school exam worthy conflict of interest going on. And he said so many terrible, stupid things, stupid for him, stupid for his client. Some of the best, I think, probably have been ones working behind the scenes who have mitigated the harm. I don't think they've successfully stopped the harm, but you could perceive during the Mueller investigation that occasionally they were somewhat cooler heads, making things maybe a little less horrible in terms of what Trump was getting away with. And I'm not entirely sure who those were, but I suspect they were some of the more experienced white-collar defense attorneys who were sort of cycling through the White House.
We have seen an unusual degree of people changing lawyers in the middle of litigation, right? It is atypical, I assume, to go through a succession of criminal defense attorneys during your criminal case, or am I mistaken about that?
It's not unusual, but it's rarely a good sign.
Yeah, right. It's a very bad sign. It's a bad sign to the judge. I mean, it's just a bad sign all the way around.
Right, because if you've gone through five lawyers, the judge is probably thinking that you're completely unreasonable.
It's like going through five spouses. The problem is probably you?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
It's why you don't take a case from someone wanting to sue their last lawyer who they hired to sue their lawyer before that. Sometimes there are just differences of opinion, or someone's rate is too high and they realize they can't afford it in the long term, or you have different strategies. But if you've got a lot of lawyer jumping, that generally indicates a problem on the client side.
But so, I mean, it seems to me in some of these cases, you had a criminal defense lawyer who was maybe pursuing a perfectly reasonable strategy, and the client, in fact, wanted an unreasonable strategy. I mean, we've seen that with Michael Flynn. We've seen a number of these cases where you have someone who's basically trying to do a more normal thing, like trying to mitigate the damage for the client, figure out what they can work out with the government, be, you know, pleasant in front of the judge, and then they get replaced with someone who's going to yell and scream.
One of the things we've talked about a lot is this gulf between PR strategy and legal strategy, and how what you might want to get on the news and to get the stories you want and the cycle you want is completely different from what you would want to make a good impression with the judge and get your best outcome in the case. So sometimes it's almost necessary to hire a new lawyer to start a new news cycle, to start a new PR strategy. Which is, I think, more or less what Flynn has done by hiring a sort of out there Larry Klayman style defense attorney who's making crazy claims because it's a gesture or a plea for a pardon and a PR strategy. So that may be one reason that you're seeing some of these cyclings, not so much because they want to change any courtroom strategy, but because they want to change the PR narrative.
Hey there, Evan George, KCRW, so we'll edit me out probably, but...
Evan, I'm sure your question will be great. We'll keep it in.
The lawyers are going to come and go. There's at least 100 plus judges who now have lifetime appointments from the Trump administration. Wondering, as lawyers who deal with the federal bench, what your thoughts are on that.
Would you like to start? You can swear.
I need my swear jar. My swear jar. Holy crap. I just think we're in trouble. I think that the judges that he's appointed, even if you maybe agree with their ideology, are just not qualified. And a lot of them don't have the temperament. And that is a scary legacy, and it's going to go on for decades. So that is a very frightening thing.
I'm most worried about the ones on the Supreme Court because they tend to last the longest. But here are a couple of reasons not to be completely terrified and curled up in a ball weeping. So the federal bench has sort of a homogenizing effect to some extent. People who become judges tend to move more towards a center or away from what's expected of them. We've seen that on the Supreme Court repeatedly historically, whether it's Earl Warren or John Roberts, who everyone perceives as moving from conservative to more centrist. It's very true on the district court, too. I've seen it over the years, judges moving away from a more overtly political to a more professional judge-type approach. And people tend to mellow. They tend to see things in a different way when they're on the bench. The experience can change them, particularly if they take it seriously, as many of them do. The office, to some extent, ennobles them a little bit. But certainly there are going to be some who are going to be terrible. The good news about that is that many wind up hating the job and wind up quitting to go work for jams and make $950 an hour as an arbitrator.
That's a good point. But I have seen the same thing, too. I mean, I think we've all been taught that in law school, and you've seen judges on the Supreme Court and elsewhere change. I totally agree with you, but I just don't know if this new flood is going to that's going to happen. I hope so.
Have the judges that he appointed, do they look any different than what you would have expected from Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush or any other sort of normal Republican who might have won the presidency?
Well, I think so because, I mean, maybe they would have let the Federal Society take over the way Trump has, but it's been very rigid ideology and people handpicked by the Federal Society in a way we've never really seen before.
It's a spectrum. I think they're a little further along the really are you serious Federal Society spectrum, but I don't know that they're like orders of magnitude different.
Steve Mandel, a long-term KCRW listener and Gould School of Law, class of 85. So there you go. Quick question about the impeachment process. It seems now when we're watching this process go through the House that the way that the witnesses are being just literally attacked, you see lifetime public servants just being completely insulted and so forth. If the process moves to the Senate, are we going to see the same type of action, or is it going to be a much more respectful matter, more like in a courtroom? Because this just seems like a joke. Like everybody that looks at it looks at this and says it's a very insulting way for witnesses to be questioned. So how does it move when it moves to the Senate?
Well, to some extent, that depends on decisions we don't know about yet. Mitch McConnell and John Roberts are going to have a lot of control over that process. And I mean, we know what happened with Bill Clinton 20 years ago, and there are certain Senate rules governing what they're going to do. In particular, Mitch McConnell said that he can't just decline to hold the trial. There had been this question people were talking about a few months ago, like, what if the House impeaches? And then McConnell's like, well, I'm not going to hold a trial in the Senate. That seems like the sort of thing that courts would be unlikely to want to interfere with, telling the Senate what, you know, what its role should be. But McConnell has said, no, Senate rules require us to hold the trial. You would need a supermajority in order to amend the rules, and we, if the House impeaches, we will try the president. The trial went on for 5.5 weeks last time around with Bill Clinton, but I don't think we know a lot about exactly how that will be conducted, and you know, to the extent that they will hear from witnesses at all, and then what that questioning will look like if they do it.
I think to the extent that John Roberts is presiding, it will be somewhat more decorous. Of course, it's not that it's all going to happen like in the Senate with all the senators there. They typically refer it to committees to hear certain segments of the evidence. You know, thinking of almost like mini juries or something that you're sending out particular issues to. And I think a lot of it will depend on whether Roberts is presiding over each of those. I mean, the senators can overrule Roberts if they want to, if they get a big enough vote. But I think he would be less inclined to allow it. And I think that the senators would be less inclined maybe to act out to the same extent that the House of Representatives had. So I would hope, I mean, it's still not going to be like a federal court trial. You're still going to be able to get away with stuff that would get you let out in handcuffs in front of a federal judge. But I think it's going to be better than the House.
But so, I mean, I guess the extent to which John Roberts has control over it, I mean, John Roberts has to be dreading this, right? John, I mean, in part because what a mess, but also in part because John Roberts's project has been, you know, pursuing the ideological and legal goals that he has at the court while trying to maintain the court's respected and removed image as a non-political institution. And so, like, the worst thing possible for him is being placed right in the middle of a political fight. So is he really going to be wanting to give a lot of specific notes to the participants in this trial about the manner in which they are allowed to conduct himself if the president's attorneys start, you know, badgering some witness or making some insane arguments? Is Roberts really going to swoop in and stop them and be the guy who was out there to get Trump, the never-Trumper on the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, he could wind up making calls in both directions. I mean, probably it's going to be staff attorneys who are doing the actual examining, and they are going to be making objections against each other, and he's going to be making rulings. I think he will be trying very hard to appear even-handed, to, you know, do the legendary call balls and strikes instead of making political decisions. And I think he's going to be inclined to run it something like a trial, in that there are some sort of bounds to how you can behave and what you can do. And I think that having a neutral, presumably referee there, is going to lead those attorneys to make objections. And I think by that time there's going to be a lot more individualized attention on the proceedings that might want them to look a little less like whatever the legal term is, you know, a huge bag of dicks.
Has Roberts ever conducted a trial? Roberts was never a trial judge.
No, I think he was an appellate attorney, so I don't think he's ever.
He was,
but he's watched lots of Law and Order. So, you know.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Eric Abelov, and I work in communications here at the university. I wanted to ask for your assessment of how the Democrats are doing. You know, obviously, an important part of building a case is building a compelling narrative. More important with this kind of impeachment proceeding, I would love to have your view. How are they doing? How are the Democrats doing?
Well, I think they should ban the phrase quid pro quo, and I also think we all in journalism and commentators should avoid Latin at all costs. And so quid pro quo, no one really knows what that means. I think they've sort of pivoted to using words that more people understand, like bribery or extortion or shakedown or whatever. So I think it's a really still hard thing to understand why this is important. I think you see Adam Schiff trying to sort of point out, like, Ukraine is still at war with Russia, which I didn't realize there's still live gunfare going on. And you know, if that crumbles, sort of the domino theory we heard a lot in Vietnam era, but, you know, why is this important to the United States' national security? But I think that's a real struggle. I don't know that it's really a really strong narrative and people can really understand why should I care. So I think they're doing better, but I still think it's really tough to make this understand, like, why is this a bad thing? Or, okay, it's a bad thing, but is it really worth, an impeachment and a conviction?
I think they've made some really smart tactical choices in a couple of ways. One is that I think Pelosi was right that just the public support was not there for an impeachment over the content of the Mueller report. Neither support among the public nor support among her caucus, and that's why she was avoiding bringing it to a vote. And then we had news events and new acts of wrongdoing that crucially were not about the past election but about a future election, and therefore were, you know, the cemented Democratic public opinion in favor of impeachment, and that's when they moved. And I think Adam Schiff has made very smart choices about the manner in which he has conducted the inquiry, that they have done all of the – they've conducted all this witness testimony in closed session. It allowed them to get separate statements from the various witnesses so they could find instances where they were in conflict. We learned about who was dissembling about various things. And also, closed sessions are better because there's no cameras. The people in the room spend their time trying to figure things out instead of acting for the cameras. I think that open congressional hearings are almost never a useful way to learn about anything. And I think it's actually telling that for the most part, when we've learned stuff in these open hearings, we've learned stuff from the opening statements, which is to say that, you know, the witness comes, they know what the important thing is to hear from them. These are not trial lawyers conducting, skilled cross-examinations, even though some of them are trial lawyers by trade, you know, in these 5-minute question periods. It's not conducive to learning much. And I think it's also not conducive to moving public opinion very much. I mean, I think what we've seen is there was a big move in public opinion about impeachment when the Ukraine story first broke. I would note it doesn't appear that there was a material move in the president's approval rating. It was more that people who disapproved of the president job performance decided that they did in fact want him to be impeached and in most cases wanted him to be removed from office. Since then, the numbers have barely moved at all. And so I think that is a sign that these hearings are not changing public minds. But I think there's an expectation among liberals that basically, like, or among a lot of liberals, that if you just, like, grabbed ordinary Americans and shook them and, like, made them pay attention to what was happening, they would change their views. And I think that's just a wrong framework. And I think, in fact, there's a good reason the president's approval rating barely moves. If you compare, this presidency compared to past presidencies, despite how noisy everything feels, the president's poll numbers have been shockingly stable through the whole process. It's like his approval never goes under 38 or over 43. But maybe that's not shocking because, like, why would anything change your opinion about Donald Trump? The things that, you know, we knew about him as of 2015, like, were enough to form the opinions that people have. And so I think that's, you know, I think that if you were expecting this to, you know, to really change everything and, you know, get Americans to, you know, to drop the approval rating to 28 such that there was a political coalition to remove him from office, I think that was, you know, you were looking for a miracle worker. That's not, you know, Adam Schiff wouldn't have been able to do that through a better tactical process.
I agree with both of them. I see, you know, reasons for constructive criticism. I see improvement in the case that they're making. I think they're doing a better job of messaging with this public segment than they did with the private one. I think they've made shrewd tactical choices, as Josh said. I particularly think that this choice not to bog everything down and wait for court rulings for every witness has turned out very well for them. But they've got something really difficult before them. And it resonates with me because I'm a criminal defense lawyer. So I know what it's like to go in against impossible odds, thinking that you don't have much of a choice. I mean, they know that they don't have the votes they need in the Senate to remove the president from office. And there's not currently much of a realistic hope that that's going to happen. But so they're faced with this saying, how do you litigate when it's likely you're ultimately going to lose? And that's the thing that, you know, as someone who supervises young associates, I have to teach them. I have to deal with it myself as a lawyer going up against the government in impossible criminal defense scenarios. And I think they're doing a decent job of that now, of conveying why it makes a difference and why it matters, even if the end result seems inevitable.
My name is Bala. I'm a student at the law school here. Don't have much knowledge coming from a foreign country. But my question is on the role played and role that is depicted in the televisions of Mr. Rudy Giuliani. Is he appointed in his individual capacity by President Trump in his individual capacity, or is he a legal advisor to the U.S. president in the official capacity? And second part of the question is, government officials taking directions from supposed to be a personal legal advisor, is that permitted? Does it become an extra constitutional role with authority but no accountability? Sorry if my question is irrelevant. I stand corrected. Thank you.
This is the central question, in fact, and this seems strange because it is strange. What has happened? This is not how the American system is supposed to work, and what you are seeing here that looks not right is, in fact, not right, and that's why it doesn't look right. I think this is a good opportunity to talk about, Ken, what you referred to earlier with the Rudy's insane conflicts of interest, which is to say, what is Rudy Giuliani? Is he an unofficial envoy of the United States to foreign countries, which is a thing that happens? Presidents will send close friends and advisors for sensitive diplomatic purposes. That can happen in a non-nefarious way. It happens in normal administrations. And that has been part of the Republican defense of the way that the president has conducted himself at times, to say, you know, when people say, oh, well, this was, you know, an irregular, you know, shady channel, they say, you know, well, presidents do this. They have back channels. But the main person arguing against that, aside from Democrats, has been Rudy Giuliani, who has been insisting to anyone who will listen that whatever he did with regard to Ukraine was solely in his capacity as the president's personal attorney. And so it seems that those things can't simultaneously be true. You can't be an unofficial envoy, but someone who is acting on behalf of the United States of America, which might be okay, and yet also be acting solely in your capacity as a personal attorney. He would have to have two capacities. He says he has only one capacity.
Giuliani has never had a particularly coherent narrative about all this, and we've heard different stories at different times. We've heard him talking about having clients outside of the United States, about working for the United States interest, about doing this in order to defend Donald Trump from potential charges, which are all very different things. And we now hear him defending himself and talking about things, including his confidential communications to the president, in the context of defending himself, which puts him directly adverse to his, at some point, client, the president. So for a while there, I think we were all trying to find a way to understand this in a way that he had some plan, that he had some master plan, and that he was not simply making it up as he went along. But I no longer believe that there's any thread going through this. I think he really has been just sort of careening from one thing to another. It seems as if he was simultaneously working for the interests of European clients while also doing things for Trump's personal interest while also acting nominally as a United States envoy. I think those were huge conflicts of interest. And I don't think we really can make it fit into a traditional legal framework. I don't think it fits there. I think it's a mistake even to go down that road.
Well, and I think I saw a headline, Rudy's friends really want him to get a lawyer. But he doesn't. I don't think he has a lawyer yet. He doesn't need one.
No, now he has a lawyer,
oh, he
right?
Does, he finally?
He said that he didn't. He had a lawyer. He fired the lawyer. He said he got rid of the lawyer because he no longer needed the lawyer. But then there were news reports that he was calling around looking for a lawyer. But I could swear I saw quotes in a news article. This and yeah, in fact, the quotes when the Lev Parnas, the thumb-headed henchman who says that had been telling associates that the president took him aside at the White House Hanukkah party last December, and tasked him on a secret mission to get Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. It was Giuliani's lawyer who gave the comment to CNN saying Lev Parnas is no Sean Connery, true, and Lev Parnas has delusions of grandeur, also most certainly true. So Giuliani not only has a lawyer, he has a lawyer who gave a pithy and seemingly appropriate comment to CNN. So that's, you know, sort of better than I would have expected for Giuliani.
Yeah, but I wouldn't advise the lawyer to have any, like, letterhead made up or anything, because I don't think he's long for this. You know, he ditched the last lawyer on the theory that once he instructed the lawyer to tell Congress, screw you, that was the end of any need for a lawyer, which is not actually how it works. So
I think he seems more focused on the public relations. He seems more focused on the narrative, on helping himself, on helping Trump, on resisting the impeachment narrative than he really does on any sort of sound criminal defense or courtroom strategy. I think he has basically gone all in and hoped for the political process to save him from these things that he's doing that are frankly suicidal with respect to his interests as a potential criminal defendant.
Right, because that's a key thing with the Parnas and Fruman indictment that, you know, they had all this business with Giuliani, and there are these news reports that that federal prosecutors are looking at whether Giuliani acted as illegally as an unregistered foreign agent, and so he probably should be worried about some of those future criminal issues. You've been listening to a special episode of All the President's Lawyers, recorded live at the USC Gold School of Law. I would note you heard only a portion of our conversation. You can hear more of it, including a conversation about impeachment testimony and about what Ken's clients as a criminal defense attorney have been learning from all the president's legal problems. You can find that conversation on the All the President's Lawyers podcast feed, and while you're there, subscribe so you never miss an episode. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our live show at USC was recorded by Phil Richards. Special thanks to the USC Gold School of Law for hosting us. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.